This week's episode is sponsored by Spaces. Spaces is a new platform backed by 15 plus years of educator feedback designed to document the process and progress behind student learning in your classroom. Join the Spaces community to connect with educators across North America and gain access to free teacher-created resources, help educators who are just starting out on their journey, and learn new things from teachers who have been there before. So visit community.spacesedu.com today.
Is this the teacher hotline?
Hello, teachers. Welcome back to another episode of the Teacher Hotline. This week, we are continuing our conversation with Mr. Fraser Grant, the head of school and deputy principal of Appleby College, where we're talking about grade inflation and how can we put an end to it. So just to review our caller's question from last week, we're going to go back to the phone lines with Christine to see what her question was.
Hey, Ron. I'm a grade 12 math teacher, and I'm really excited for the start of the school year. One thing that always weighs on my mind teaching senior students is their grades. It's always a battle between the parents or students versus myself in giving a quote-unquote fair grade. I love teaching grade 12s, but this is the part I hate the most. It bothers me when I hear other kids say that I got an easy grade from so-and-so's class or math is easier at another school. In my opinion, I think grade inflation is real. But the question is, as a teacher, how can we prevent this from happening in our own classrooms? Or is this something where the ministry or university needs to step in and do something about? Because I'm a bit tired of always trying to defend the grades I give my students.
Thank you so much again, Christine, for that wonderful question. And it is definitely a tough problem to solve. So this week, we are back with Mr. Fraser Grant. And we're going to talk about some solutions of how we can potentially solve this issue of grade inflation. Now, also last week, we talked about the various reasons why grades have increased over the years. But the one thing we haven't talked about last week is grade grubbing. And we kind of all experience it here at Appleby as well, where students or families come to you and be like, you know, Mr. Grant, you know, Jimmy over here, I think he really deserves a 95, but really the kid's getting, you know, an 82 or 70 at best. And teachers, I could tell you from my own personal experience, it's a lot of pressure. If it happens once, no big deal, but it happens year after year after year, which I do at grade 12, it could be exhaustive, tiresome, and frankly, very, very annoying. And I could see that after, you know, let's say 15, 20 years in the profession, you kind of just think to yourself, you know what, it's just easier to give this kid an A. I don't want to deal with parents. I don't want to deal with administration and guidance and deal with all of this. So I would imagine that grade grubbing probably plays a small role or perhaps maybe even a large role in terms of seeing grades creep up over the years. So my first question is, do you have any funny stories of over the last 27 years of people asking for ridiculous asks in their grades when they clearly don't deserve it?
I'm not going to name names, but the only, what I always find interesting is when a student, and I think this is sort of gets at the heart of it, which I want to sort of talk about, which is assessment strategies a little bit. But I think part of it is when the student has no idea why they got the grade, right? And they can't put their finger on it, or maybe they're not communicating what the entire story home. Because, as you know, at Appleby, all our grade 12s are in boarding, and they're the ones who really are most keenly interested in their grades, and because they're looking ahead. I would argue they are the ones that also are most confident in terms of approaching a teacher and sort of requesting things, you know, it comes with age and maturity and also confidence. I always struggle when, you know, a parent comes forward with a request or asks for something and then there's a surprise at the end of the story. And there maybe question a grade or something, and you have to, you know, be quite open and honest and say, well, here's why they didn't get the grade, and you send them a copy of the test or assignment, or they didn't hand something in. So your answer is, well, they got a zero because they never handed it in. And then, of course, it becomes an issue between the student and the parent. And I think when that happens, that's always a bit of an uncomfortable, because the student is communicating one thing home, the parents think something else is happening, and you as a teacher are kind of caught in the middle. And I think those can be really uncomfortable situations when you sort of expose the truth and say, well, actually, this wasn't done, and here's why, or it was 2 weeks late. And, you know, and I think that's an interesting scenario. I think I've never had a situation where a student has come and said, I need, well, they've tried. They said, I need a 98 to get into Queen's Commerce, and you've given me an 88. What can we do? What can we do? I mean, and I think then that's a question of being confident in your assessment strategy as a professional. And, you know, Growing Success talks about that for sort of Ontario educators, that professional, at the end of the day, there's a professional judgment piece in assigning grades and marks for students, that you as the teacher, through a, you know, a variety of assessment strategies, not just marks, are able to sort of give a mark based on your judgment of where that student is in relation to sort of the ministry expectations. And I think that's something especially younger teachers struggle with. I think over time, you know, you as a veteran teacher, me as a even more veteran teacher, you know, we're able to sort of look at our students and look at the ministry expectations and really identify where they're surpassing, where their weaknesses. And I think, you know, we become experts in a sense at assigning grades based on at the end of the year. I think the trickiest part, Ron, is when you're assigning grades partway through a year or early on in a year, and a student struggles, and then maybe they get a 62 on the first assignment. And if it's the first test or first assignment, that's 100% of their grade. And students wrapping their heads around that is like, how much is this weighted? Well, it's weighted at 100% because it's your first test. So that's your mark. And then I think that's the biggest struggle. And when I find the most panic and worry among students, is it really in that first third of the year when everything they're doing is weighted so heavily, you don't have enough formative work from them to see them in class presentation, to know at the heart what those kids know. It's early on in the year when assigning marks can be, and you get the biggest panic.
I hate parent-teacher interviews that first time around when October, November hits, and that first report card that goes out in what, November? Because again, just speaking for myself, in grade 12 accounting, even grade 11 accounting, we usually only have maybe one, maybe at most two assessments in the report card. And I could tell you from last year in our first semester, especially when things were so crunched in, I had to kind of redesign how my course looked. And when that first report card came out, there was maybe, I think there was only one test for grade 12s, and people were freaking out. Like, people were dropping my course like flies. Like, and I had to like talk them out of it. I'm like, relax. Like, this is only one test, but they see the 60 or even the 50 on that report card, and that's all they see. And it becomes very, very challenging to explain to them the logic, even though they're all very smart people. They can all do math. They can't comprehend that this is just one test, and they go into full-fledged panic mode.
So I think that's the biggest struggle. It's not necessarily by the end of the year. Like, rarely do I hear from a student at the end of the year, because there's been enough, they have trust in you as a teacher. There's been a track record of performance. You know, you've done a number of assessment strategies over time, right? And I think that's the key, right? Is that all those extra assessment of learning strategies and for learning strategies, right? Where you've got, you know, feedback without grades, peer assessment, self-assessment, summative and formative assignments, and it all puts together the big picture of here's your grade.
Right.
I think it's the interim grades, the early grades, which cause the most panic.
So let's talk about then, in terms of this grade inflation thing that we've been talking about, in your opinion, do we need to fix or reverse some of this grade inflation that we see? Or in a perfect world, what needs to actually happen to reverse or kind of level the playing field a little bit in terms of, because at the end of the day, right, grades can only go up to 100%. And
that's right. Right. Like, and I think we're almost at the peak.
Right. We're almost at the peak. Like, I think, what was it? Like, I mean, there's some schools asking for 95 averages, 90 plus averages. Like, at what point does that stop? Whereas in an economy, prices can go up forever as long as, you know, income moves at the same rate. But grades, there's a cap to it. So do you think, in your opinion, grades need to be reversed to kind of go back into our olden days where you say an 80 is kind of good? Does it need to be fixed? And what needs to happen?
I think a couple things. I think we can't go backwards until the sort of clients we serve ultimately, which are the post-secondary institutions, take a retrenchment and look at their policies too. So we could, I mean, imagine us as a school saying, okay, we're going to change all, we're going to default and say, I mean, I'm just making this up. We're going to discount our grades by a factor of 10 or whatever. None of our kids would be getting into the top programs. So ultimately, nothing can change until universities look at their policies and programs. I think what's interesting is some Canadian universities are slowly looking at different admission requirements, as they do across the UK and the US, where, you know, as much weighting is placed on the personal statements, personal essays. You know, I think likely their admission requirements are a little more equalized across, here's your mark, you know, here's your SAT grade. We can talk about that in a second. And then here's your personal essays, your everything to back up and show that you, what type of person you are, whether it be a digital portfolio, which is something which is really, really interesting to me to introduce. And I think there's a growing body across the US introducing and sort of involved in this mastery transcript program, which isn't linked primarily to courses and marks. So I shouldn't say courses, isn't primarily linked to the marks, but includes and gives students the opportunity to showcase their work in other areas. So showcase more of their service involvement, their experiential involvement. Here are some key projects I'd love to share with you. Here's some project-based learning I involved in. Here's a co-op placement. And they look at the complete mastery of that student in a transcript form, which is then shared with universities. The problem in Canada, of course, is it's all you're uploading to the OUAC is your grade. Mm-hmm. There's no opportunity for that personalization. I think that's coming with more and more schools, but it's very slow in Canada. And I think it's going to be years till that's adopted.
And I would imagine
what would be that?
I was just going to say, I feel like as a university admissions officer, even if that was possible, I feel like that would be such a time suck as well, right? Like grades is kind of, It's black and white. If you don't meet this cutoff, boom, you're in, you're out. But with some of that personalization piece, it becomes more of a lag in terms of sifting through that information, which I can mm-hmm. see why maybe perhaps like for a first year program, admission officers might not want to do that. But may want to do that for, like, let's say, a grad program like med school, for instance.
Right. And I think some schools, like I know Queen's Commerce has a personal essay and statement, but, you know, it's a mystery, the weighting process. How much is the mark versus how much is that personal essay and those? I don't know. And I think which is more important? I'm not sure. Right. Like, will the door be open to them even read your essays if you don't have an 89 or a 92? I don't know which comes first. I think it's the mark filter, and then they look at the essays.
I want to go back to Waterloo because that was a huge piece of news back in, 2019 when that first came out, 2018, 2019, where you alluded to they started adding this adjustment factor to your grade based off of what school you came from. And they published a list of schools publicly. I almost felt like it was public shaming in a way. What schools were essentially, quote unquote, giving away these grades for free. But in a way, it makes sense, at least my first impression of it, right? Like if you know this school is a common offender of just constantly just giving out 99 averages, it makes sense to add that adjustment factor. And I think I was reading on Global News that some of the worst schools saw students, their average drop about 27% from Waterloo Engineering to about from high school to university. And on average, a school that wasn't on that list would drop about roughly 16%, which sounds about right, given what teachers always have told me, your grades are going to fall about roughly 10%. So this adjustment factor, your first impressions, is Waterloo moving in the right direction in terms of leveling the playing field for grade inflation? Are they the pioneers of doing something that we should all be doing? Or are they moving in the wrong direction, you think?
I always look at who would be hurt most, right? And what's the damage caused by something like this? So you think if you, and again, I'm not going to name schools, but if you graduated from one of those high schools, which has shown across the board a 27% drop once those students get to Waterloo, but you're a student who's very strong, very capable, and wouldn't necessarily get lumped in there, are you going to be disadvantaged by your cohort of classmates and what's happening at that school? If you just happen to be a student at that school by chance, because that's in your postal code, right? What happens to that student? Are they going to be disadvantaged and maybe turned away by Waterloo because of the, they painted this school with this brush? So I worry a little bit about that. And that list also, you know, and you look at sort of some of the socioeconomic factors in terms of where are those schools located in terms of postal code areas, other socioeconomic factors. I just worry a little bit about branding schools with a one sort of brush that then leaves people to interpret things which may not be true. So I understand why they did it. I'm not sure why it was published, because I think I'll be honest, I think every university has those lists.
Yeah.
They must, because they must know, and it would only be sensible and logical for university admissions officers to work with the business departments to sort of realize that students from these schools don't last. Stop admitting so many from these schools, because we want to make sure that students who are admitted stay here.
I think I actually read in the Global News that they originally didn't publish it. I think, I can't remember, someone was pushing Waterloo to release that information. Apparently it's illegal, something about I'm forgetting the name of it now, but there's a law where you actually have to release information like that. I'm going to have to fact check myself. And I think Waterloo eventually just said, all right, here you go.
You don't have a team behind you?
I don't have a team, where we're not that big yet. I need to get someone to fact check for me, like they do on the Joe Rogan podcast.
Yeah, maybe your accounting students. Yeah. That can be a co-op
co-op program for my podcast over here.
That's one worry I have, and I don't know, but I guarantee you that all universities have those lists.
That would make sense. Why wouldn't you? If you have the data.
If they don't, I think they're not doing their jobs.
Yeah, I agree.
It wouldn't make sense. So, you know, I also don't want to call out University of Waterloo, because I think either they released it by accident, got caught, were forced to, whatever. I don't know the details either. I can't remember. But I bet you Western,
I would imagine, Queens,
McMaster, they all have those similar lists.
You mentioned SATs earlier. And at our school, our grade 10s have to do the practice SAT more as a formative assessment to see, you know, is this something that if you want to go into the US, nope, here's a practice shot at a grade 10. If you want to do it for real, you have an opportunity down the road. So in the US, you have to write the standardized test to get into these schools, whereas in Canada, we obviously don't. From a first initial look at it, it seems to make sense, right? It kind of eliminates the potential of, let's say, going back to what I was saying, my credit not being the same worth as another school's credit. It just makes sense to do. But there's a lot of backlash against standardized testing. So maybe for context, why is standardized testing getting so much backlash? And number two, do you think that in Canada we should have some sort of standardized testing to admit students into universities?
It's a great question. When you think about standardized testing, sort of one of my educational sort of heroes is the late Sir Ken Robinson, And I love his quote when he says sort of that the educational testing business, College Board SAT, he argues contributed nothing to the improvement of students or teachers throughout history and represents a $16 billion industry. So I don't think, regardless of any of the positive attributes and sort of maybe sense that these testing agencies are engaged in the greater good. I mean, it's a $16 billion a year industry. So I think that has to be the starting point. And I think the trend across, you know, when we look at the US is colleges moving away from that SAT requirement. And I think in Canada, and certainly Ontario, we moved away from standardized testing as, you know, and if you think, you know, back in the 60s, I'm not sure when it ended, but every, you know, grade 12 history student would write the same grade 12 history test across Ontario. And in some provinces that still exists where there's common testing. I think the problem with SATs and those things is they've been demonstrated to have a racial socioeconomic bias in the questions. And that's why there's been court cases brought against universities and the College Board as a result of that, in terms of the types of questions. So I think at its heart, that standardized testing, that's one significant issue, which we haven't seen as much of in Canada, but I would argue still exists. The other issue, of course, we have is, you know, the idea of teaching to the test. And how does that change the whole issue of what a student is focused on in the classroom and learning? I really struggle with the standardized test from the standpoint of teachers really teaching to the test, and everything is geared towards the test. And I think we see a little bit of that with our advanced placement. I believe in the advanced placement program because I think for certain students and certain subjects who really want to dive deeply into a subject, it has great merit. But there's always that concern about teachers teaching to the test because they want to see their students and they want to, you know, achieve a 3 or a 4 or a 5 on that, you know, advanced placement test. And similarly, it would be to the SAT, where the SAT scores are reported back and schools are rated based on their SAT scores. And I think that's the ultimate sort of issue, is then funding goes to those schools where the SAT scores across their school are higher. And so, of course, there's incentive to game the system. Yeah. So I think anywhere there's incentive to game the system and move away from the sort of educational philosophy and the goals of education, where you're just teaching to the test, I have a problem with.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because, you know, at the high school level, we are fortunate enough to have the ability to build a rapport with our students with the small classes. I know some teachers might not agree with the definition of a small class with... I know here at Appleby, we're very, very fortunate. We have classes of under 20. But even if you, let's say, on a large class for at a, you know, public school up to, let's say, 35 plus, that's still a lot smaller than a university classroom of, you know, a whole lecture hall. So you can still make the argument that you can build this relationship with a student. And that's the challenge, right? Once you have this relationship with the students, to your earlier point, right, we're just a stepping stone. And you want them to succeed and move to the next level. And when you have these standardized testing, you know, you want to prep them for this test at the end of the day, even though that might come at the sacrifice of perhaps, you know, genuine learning. It makes it very, very challenging. It's, you know, you got to choose one or the other. And you're right. I don't know. I don't really know what my opinion is right now on standardized testing, because to your point, it's one of those things where it fixes this glaring issue, but it comes at a cost. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to go back to your earlier point about a prof at Harvard, Harvey Mansfield.
Oh yeah,
he came up with a solution. I don't know if you heard about the solution, which is why I kind of snarkled when you brought his name up. But
oh, I know where you're going with it. I know.
He came up with the solution to combat grade inflation, where he would actually give two grades to students. The first grade would be, you know, your quote unquote grade, which he doesn't actually believe in, but he's going to give it to you to kind of use as a stepping stone for another program or for a job application. But he's going to give you a second grade back of what he truly believes you actually deserved on the test. That way, number one, you get what you want. You know, you get to move on and submit your transcript to the next school. And number two, you get to find out what I actually feel about you or your coursework. My first reaction to that was, that is genius. I want to do that immediately. Your initial thoughts when you heard about this this tactic by Harvey Mansfield?
I'm pretty sure he's an econ prof.
Yes, he is.
Because only an econ prof would be so sinister. and I can say that would be so. And so I've actually done I shouldn't say this. First of all, I think it's a very interesting process, but I think it undermines the whole idea of grading to sort of say, here's your mark. I just think it undermines your whole professional judgment, because people will always call into question, though, what do the grades mean? Yeah. So I that's my problem with it. I think professionally, there's a real problem with it. I run an experiment in my class at the start of the year where I've said, okay, let's play this game. Everyone gets a 93. You don't have to do anything. I'll give everyone a 93. We can come here and just talk about, we can watch Netflix, we can do nothing, but everyone was guaranteed a 93. All you have to do is come to class and not tell anyone. As the assistant head of academics in charge of the whole academic program, this was my proposal for my students. Every year you can ask them. I said, I would ask them, put your head down on the desk, close your eyes, and raise your hand if you're willing to accept this. And if you're not, keep your hand down and we won't go ahead with it. I've never had I've probably run it 8 years now, because I read about something similar. I've never had all the students accept that. And I just made up a 93. I think I could choose any grade, maybe not 99.
Right.
But they won't accept it, because there's inherently sort of that level of competition where I think I can do better. And I think if I work hard and I just sort of run it as a silly experiment to say, you know, you guys have been brought up to believe if you work hard, study, that you're going to be rewarded. And that's sort of the whole idea of capitalist system. And I said, there's nothing more capitalist than school. You guys are all competing against, not against each other, but against this grading system. So I'm pretty open with it. I'm saying, I'm not going to hold you back. You know, you hear in some classes and some courses, teachers very proudly say, I've never given out 100, or I've never given out a 99. It's impossible to earn that in this course. Mm-hmm. It's too difficult. I think that's nonsense.
Right.
If a student works hard and achieves all of the expectations that they should, and sort of meets all the expectations and surpasses them and is a level 4 or 5 in all of their work, they should be rewarded.
Right.
And I really believe that. And the interesting thing is, I'm going to ask you a question back.
Please go ahead.
I don't know if that's allowed in your podcast format to me to ask you a question.
I'm the host. I allow it.
Would you say that some years you have a stronger cohort of kids than others? And it's not necessarily explainable. Mm-hmm. But when you look at averages and medians across, and you know, some years you will not have, say, the same median or a lower median and a lower average than other years. And so let's say one year your median let's say your median one year is 89, and the next year it drops to 85. Mm-hmm. Are you concerned about grade deflation?
No, not at all.
Why are we so concerned about grade inflation?
Interesting.
This is sort of at the heart of it. I don't, if the grades were dropping, because it's something interesting for the media to sort of grab onto and people to worry about. And you hear accusations of, oh, marks at this school are so easy. But at the end of the day, the student, at the heart of it is the student well-being and future success. And if we're giving them fake marks, they're not going to do well at post-secondary institutions. And I think we see evidence, at least at Appleby, that our kids do well at post-secondary school. And, you know, they do perform well. Of course, we have situations where students don't thrive, but that's historically, you know, a percentage across all schools and all students. But I think we, you know, I just don't buy the grade inflation thing. And I think it's driven by an external factor. So to your point of, can we reset the whole system? Only if only if post-secondary schools are willing to work with high schools to reframe the whole situation.
Right. That's.
But otherwise, I think we're stuck.
I want to wrap up with one more question. I'm looking at the time over here. Private schools and independent schools, when it comes to grade inflation and giving out grades, in the media at least, or even just in our inner circle of friends, grades and easy grades a lot of time attached to private schools. And like you said, independent schools, private schools, we're kind of all lumped into to one category, mm-hmm. even though we're not the same. And I know my circle of friends, you know, you hear this saying all the time, right? Oh, parents, they're just buying grades. You know, you go to Appleby College, you go to any school, yeah, they're just buying grades. It's very, very easy to get grades there. And me being a teacher in the classroom, I'm actually insulted because I'm like, talk to some of my students and I don't think they would agree with you there. But we hear that very often. And I don't know if that's a stereotype that's going to go away. So you have the opportunity right now to our listeners. What would you say to those people who are listening who are a little bit skeptical about grades and students earning their grades here at a school, let's say Appleby College, mm-hmm. who are skeptical about perhaps parents just paying tuition and buying those grades? What systems are in place to ensure that that's not a thing that actually happens at our school?
Mm-hmm. Well, my first response would be I'd use two sort of comments. One would be, I think that's lazy. I think that's extremely lazy analysis because that's an easy target and it makes no sense. And the other thing is, I think it's far too cynical, you know, an attitude towards an educational system, which, you know, look at a school like Appleby, around 110 years. If we were faking it, someone would have figured it out. Right? And ultimately, the proof in the pudding is, look at our students and their success at university, other post-secondary schools. Across the independent school market, I don't think you see our kids failing out because we're faking and giving them grades for money. Let me tell you this, if we were giving grades for money and I was in the assistant head role for the past, whatever, 10 years, I'd be driving in brand new Tesla every year. I drive a pickup truck, Ron. So I don't think that any of that's true. I mean, how could it be? I mean, I think it's lazy. And you know, I don't give it any credit. It's just ridiculous.
To wrap things up, Fraser, we are out of time here. As our new leader, captain, dean, deputy of this ship of Appleby College, what message do you have for the Appleby community and our faculty members about this upcoming year? Any words of to fire people up for September?
Yeah, I think one would be, I'm super excited to see everyone back on campus. We had a small taste of that in June when people were able to come back and celebrate sort of people who are retiring. And I'm so glad we were able to do that and leaving the school. But next September 1st, when we're all back on campus, I'm super excited to see everyone. And I think rest up because it's going to be an energetic, fun year. I'm excited. I'm really excited. And I think the students, there is an unpent sense of emotion and energy ready to be unleashed on campus. You know, with everyone back, you think of this year's grade 12s, which I almost have had a year and a half of being absent from school. They are ready to rock and they are ready to be back in boarding, co-curricular, sport. It's going to be a pretty exciting year. I hope some of our elderly faculty like myself are going to be able to keep up with the energy and the expectations because, you know, as you and I know, teaching from home in our pajamas, it's a little bit cushier than what we would experience at a normal Appleby day.
Definitely.
Where we're running here, running there, co-curriculars, after school, sports, service. I think, you know, I can only speak for myself.
Yeah.
Teaching in my pajamas. I can't do that next year.
Well, you can. You're, like I said, you're the new deputy principal.
Sure. Right. Maybe we'll introduce that. We do have a change, Ron, which will be exciting, which you'll hear about. So we're the students are having a little bit of a, as we did last year when we started school. And for all your listeners, I'll release this little tidbit, this surprise now for all the Appleby people listening. Ooh. The students are, of course, as last year, were able to wear polo shirts, and we sort of changed the uniform expectations. And so up until Thanksgiving, students will be in their polos or quarter zips. They don't have to wear tie and blazer every day. Yeah. Faculty, and you know what, the interesting thing is, I had a discussion with Dr. Morrison and Dr. Kelly around this. It more applies to the male faculty. And this isn't a gender thing at all. I'm not going there. Male teachers won't need to wear ties.
Wow.
Up until Thanksgiving as well. And I know you love your ties.
Wow. That's huge. First order of business as the deputy principal.
We're going to mirror the students. So we'll have a little bit more relaxed dress code for teachers up until Thanksgiving, warm weather. And then following May long weekend, a little more relaxed as well. So students will be in polos and quarter zips, and we'll be able to not wear a tie.
I bet you've been thinking about this plan since 1987, haven't you? You're like, when I become principal of this goddamn place one day, I am getting rid of the ties.
That was my first order of business. But we're not getting rid of ties altogether. Don't say that. Don't start that rumor.
You guys heard it first here. Exclusive on the teacher hotline. Well, Fraser, thank you so much. I really enjoyed having this conversation with you today. I really appreciate it. And again, congratulations on this brand new role. We're really excited to have you lead this ship, and it's going to be an exciting school year. So again, congratulations and thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Ron. Pleasure. Really enjoyed it. And I hope we get a few listeners.
Well, to all of our listeners globally, thank you for tuning in to this week's edition of the Teacher Hotline. Again, if you enjoy this content, feel free to follow us on Facebook and Instagram. And of course, don't forget to click that subscribe button on Apple, Spotify, Google, and wherever else you get your podcast from. And we'll see you next Monday. Take care, everybody.